Hello, this is Phyllis Furumoto with Reiki Balancing Form and Essence. Today we have with us Gordon Melvin. He is from the UK, and I interviewed Gordon in 2007, and in fact, we did an archived show with him just 2 or 3 weeks ago, I believe. And in going through the archives, I was shocked to find out that it had been 5 years since I interviewed Gordon, and I've had some contact with him in between and realized that there's so much more to talk about that I'm just thrilled that he can come back on the show again. So, Gordon, please thank you very much for making this time for us.
Well, it's my great pleasure.
Great.
Thank you.
You're welcome. What I'd love to do is to start out, as usual, with asking you about your Reiki story. How did you come to find out about Reiki, and what drew you to Reiki, and what were the interesting highlights of your early Reiki experience? Excuse me.
Well, I probably shared with you that I had, first of all, not a very positive experience of Reiki, but I soon put that behind me. I got involved with a master that didn't really have very much idea of what Reiki was. We were doing past life regression and crystals and cowboys and guides and things, but no Reiki. And she asked me to leave the class early before all the initiations took place. And I knew that it was entirely wrong. And I just knew I had to leave. And it was very, very disturbing. But then I came across somebody that knew a woman that lives locally called Chips Morton. Uh-huh. And she gave me my first proper treatment, and from then on there, Reiki took care of itself. Chips gave a fabulous treatment, and Reiki spoke volumes, and I thought, if this is what this is, then this is what I want. A non-kind of intellectual, body-orientated, completely sensible thing that feels wonderful and has, you know, it's completely intelligent on its own without me interfering with it.
Right. Well, just as a little aside for the listeners, you can go back into the archives and find Chips's interview. It's fabulous. And she's still around giving great treatments.
Yeah, she's an amazing woman.
She is an amazing woman. So your first treatment was with Chips. That's really wonderful. Nice connection. So then what happened?
She put me in touch with Margaret Rose.
Uh-huh.
And I chased her up, and we eventually organized a class, and I went along and had my first degree, and it was a sublime weekend, sublime peace, and absolutely wonderful in every way, very, very healing. And then I chugged along for about a year and a half, I think, and I did my second degree. And when I got my second degree, that was my Reiki moment. I think that that's what I really wanted, because I do pray, and I wanted to do something that I could do with in a prayerful way that was to do with my hands and healing and, in a way, transpersonal. And second degree was amazing because I could send treatments and I could move forward in time and backwards in time, and I could also send a treatment to myself. If I was sitting on a train and I was anxious, I could just send myself a treatment, or I could send a treatment to myself mentally. So it opened up another dimension, and I think the penny dropped then. I thought, this truly is absolutely extraordinary. And it opened up a whole new world for me, and thank God for second degree.
Uh-huh. Can I just go back and ask you a
yes.
couple of questions? So when you said a transpersonal experience, what does that mean to you?
It means to me that I don't have to be a saint. I don't have to be goody-two-twos. I don't have to have pure little thoughts and strain my muscles focusing on goodness. I simply have to have a wish. I know, it sounds good. This is a good system for bad people. I could sit there and just be whoever I am. The transpersonal quality of Reiki interests me, that I didn't have to improve myself. I didn't have to be anything.
Ah,
I didn't have to be
right.
pure as a driven snow. I just simply had to have the wish and believe it, that this worked. And with the intention and using the symbols, I could send a treatment. So it was extraordinary. It cut across time, space, and ego.
Mm-hmm.
Ego transplant. Bias. So it suited me fine.
Oh, great. Great. Well, that's clear. So then I don't know how long it had been since you had second degree that I met you. When was that, Gordon?
I think I did second degree in 2003.
Uh-huh.
In May of 2003, I'm pretty certain. I had an amazing experience because I'd taken the weekend off from work, and I came into work. I worked in a hospital then, and there was a chap, a member of staff, who was very poorly, and he'd just been diagnosed with cancer, and he didn't want to see anybody but the doctors and me, and his wife called me and said, can you go and see Paul? He really wants to see you. And I listened to him and talked to him, and I was suddenly filled with this idea. I thought, I think I might tell him what I did this weekend and talk about Reiki. And so I did, and I said, I could send you a treatment. He said, oh, please send me a treatment. And he was a guy that professed to believe in nothing, but he was a big softy underneath, and he did. Anyway, he fell in love with Reiki, and both he and his wife have done first degree, and he's alive to tell the story, and this is some time ago. And I organized a team of people, and he had Reiki for 3 or 4 months every single evening at 7 o'clock.
Wow.
And his whole household stilled and became quiet. They had a completely deranged cat, and the cat became quiet, and the dog became quiet, and the goldfish sat still, and you know what I mean, they all behaved. And he fell in love with Reiki, and about 6-7 months later, an oncologist at the hospital where I worked pulled me up in the corridor, and he said to me, you do Reiki, don't you? And I thought, oh, oops, here we go. I said, yes. And he said, I didn't know you did Reiki. And I said, yes. And he said, you've been giving it to Paul, haven't you? And I was the hospital chaplain, so it was a bit tricky. And I said, yes, I have been giving it to Paul. He said, keep on giving it to him. He shouldn't be alive. I think it makes a difference. Send him Reiki. Thank you.
Wow.
And this was a man who lost his wife. He was a young man with 3 children, and he very tragically lost his wife. She died as a cancer patient in the hospital. Obviously, he wasn't in charge of her case, but so he's been through it. He knows what loss is. So that was another interesting turning point with Reiki and Paul and second degree, because Paul didn't really like on hands. He wanted it sent. Oh, but once he did first degree, he and his wife would exchange treatments.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wow. So tell me, I guess I'm really curious about hospital chaplains. Do you have a certain faith that you practice?
Oh, gosh, you do ask difficult questions.
This would be one of the easy ones.
See me afterwards. Right. Well, I left the hospital very nearly 8 years ago. I left at the end of 2004 to reinvent myself. I am still a priest, licensed by the bishop, and I do a few priestly things, but I'm an undercover priest. I don't need people to know. I don't go pouncing about with a black shirt on and a collar any longer, but I believe that I have a priestly ministry, but it's quiet. I occasionally do funerals, but my faith is general. I'm steeped in Christianity. I have a small little steep in Buddhism. I don't need to practice an outward faith to be who I am.
Uh-huh.
So I don't do devotional things to do with my faith. I do things like pray and meditate and work on myself and send Reiki to things and try to be appropriate in life.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't celebrate high days and holidays and remember the Christian calendar and things of that. I mean, I probably know it's Christmas, but I'm post religion and post devotion.
Sorry.
That's who I am, and I can say what I like now and be what I like, and that's really important.
Uh-huh. So, is this an Episcopal priest or a Roman Catholic?
Church of England. So
Church of England. Sorry.
No.
Wrong. None of the above. Okay, well, that's really clear. Post-religious. So I suppose that a lot of Reiki people would talk about, well, I think there are two interesting things that I have heard from people who have had the church, whatever church it is, be very prominent in their lives. Sometimes their story sounds quite a bit like yours, and they might describe themselves later on as being post-religious. But then for other people, they find that it draws them more firmly into their religious practice. And I'm just wondering, do you have anything to say about that? Not that it's, I'm not trying to do an oppositional thing. I'm just trying to explore this particular quality of Reiki, which I find really confuses a lot of people. It's like it becomes whatever we need it to become. So then, if that's so, why is it so effective? I think that for me, I grew up with this idea that you took a certain drug and it was effective for a certain thing, and that's why you got well. And it was a very linear kind of approach. So how can the same methodology, for instance, reduce high blood pressure and raise low blood pressure? Like, how can that be? Or how can Reiki allow someone to step outside the normal confines of a practice, a religious practice, or for some other people, go deeper?
Okay. I'm completely at home with the essence of Christ's teaching, and it is part of me, and it's a core part of me.
Uh-huh.
I don't enjoy the outward stuff. Particularly as a priest, I don't enjoy dressing up. I don't enjoy reenactments. Reiki had absolutely nothing to do with my moving to the side of the church I moved to the side of the church and I became slightly invisible, but I'm more visible than I ever was in a funny kind of way. Reiki was simply the missing link in terms of a physical practice. And a physical practice that had absolutely nothing to do with self-improvement, with huge amount of knowledge about being good or pure or whatever. It just simply was a gift, and it's been used hugely, and it's entirely linked to my daily practice of being still and contemplation and prayer and all those things.
Mm-hmm.
So it had nothing to do with it. My move to the left of the church was vocational. I did not have the type of personality that could stomach being in the church for the rest of my life, because I have a bigger picture and I cannot be limited by the picture. Now, the thing that the church as an organization, institution, doesn't recognize is levels. And I've been following the teaching of Gurdjieff since 1983, and he talked about levels. And we're all at different vibrational levels, different parts of us at different levels. I don't need those things. I don't need to be angry with them. I don't need to be dismissive of them or with them. I simply don't need to be involved with them. They're not mine to do. So that's what I did. And I have another passion, which is the Enneagram, and that was looming large. And I have other passions as well. I'm writing a book at the moment. So I needed to be more free and less cluttered, and be able to deal with anybody and everybody and anything, rather than just concerns of the sort of paid-up members of a club. And so I do work in the church. I'm invited to speak, and I enjoy it very much. I'm possibly going to be working in a theological college next year. I've got that to deal with next week. So I like working in the church, but it's on my terms, in as much that I work with a priest in Wales. And the first time I worked with him, I said, I would love to do that. That's fine. As long as you understand it's Holy Week and I will not dress up, I will not do reenactments, and I will not do piety. He said, I didn't expect you would. So I did the spiritual input and challenging talk and held the silence, and that was fine.
Wonderful. Well, it's amazing that someone, I don't know, somehow... Now, it's not my impression that churches, you know, the actual structure, let's see, how can I say that? The administrative structure of a church would actually allow someone to set their own terms. And I'm really amazed and really happy that has been, that you've been able to do that, because it means that you were not asked to choose.
Well, the bishop said to me, one bishop said to me after I left, and he's a very wise man, he lives just around the corner from me, and he said, I wish you every blessing in your new ministry. And I said, oh, you call it a ministry? And he said, yes, you haven't done anything wrong, you haven't had a crisis of faith, you haven't burned out, you know what you don't want to do, and the church in its folly doesn't have a place for people that don't do services. And so you reinvented yourself, and he said, if anything, you're full of it, because you're full of the joys of it all. And I said, well, that means an enormous amount to me, because that's how I see it as well. I said, I'm full of it, and I'm doing what I'm called to do, and it's an ongoing disclosure, and now I need to be more free. I've had 14 years in the National Health Services as a hospital chaplain. I've walked in the valley of the shadow of death. I've been with everybody and anybody, and I've loved it. But I have had enough. There's more to life than death. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I had a spell where I had a concentrated time with death, and it was wonderful. But I needed to be more free and to work in the outside arena of life with people that are not just thinking about physical problems and the spiritual implications.
Right.
So I'm doing something different.
Right. Well, I'm very tempted to ask you about the Valley of the Shadow of Death, but I think we should go in another direction. Maybe that's another interview. I don't know. But I'm really curious to know then how you met the Enneagram and how that entered your life, because I know that it's become a big part of your life. And I see it as this incredible template, maybe we could call it, that allows people to see, it creates another way for people to look at the world and how it works.
Yes.
Creating another kind of cosmology based not on a Christian story of Adam and Eve, for instance, which was my beginning cosmology. And for a long time, I used to hang out with American Indian tribes, and I just longed for some other cosmology that was based on, you know, the stories of how the Big Bear met, you know, the North Star, and they coupled and had children, and that's how the Earth came about and all that. But I couldn't really relate to it because I didn't have the context.
Yes.
And that's the same for me with the Enneagram. Like I don't really know much about it. I just know that a lot of people use it in ways that I don't really find very helpful. And I see that behind that kind of surface use of sort of telling people what they're like and what they don't like, there's another really depth of universal truth and perception that lies at the base of the Enneagram and its philosophy, if I may use that word. So I'd love to know more about it, because I just feel like a lot of people are like me. They just don't get it.
Okay, well, I get that you don't get it. And I'm dying to tell you some more, so hopefully I'll do some justice.
Okay, all right.
I came across, and you better be careful and tell me to shut up eventually.
I will.
I came across the Enneagram in 1983, and it was a map of universal laws which affect everything that from the ancient world, but had been perhaps reconfigurated at various times in history and represented by a man called Gurdjieff, who was said to be a master and a fully realized man, born in the 19th century and died in 1949, and brought a teaching often called esoteric Christianity to the West and to Western Europe in the early part of the 20th century. Anyway, the diagram represents universal laws, the law of three, the law of seven, and it is extraordinary. And for years I walked on top of it, doing sacred dances, which were about awakening the centers, the three brains.
Uh-huh.
And in 1995, somebody at the hospital gave me a sheet of paper with nine descriptions of nine different types of people, nine different souls, nine different egos. And it was called the personality typology of the Enneagram. And I looked at this, and my whole life changed within a space of 5 minutes. I got myself in about 3 minutes, and I got a lot of other salient people. And I thought, I can forgive them all now. I can forgive myself. This is not me. I've been doing this thing all my life. It is not me. My ego calls it me. I have identified with it. I have created myself a great deal of suffering and other people, and I have limited myself. This system is about recognizing the blueprint of my defensive reactive pattern, my outer person, which I need, thank God for it, bless it. But I don't need any more of it. I've got enough. And it led me to question, well, who am I if I'm not this pattern, which I thought I was? And I thought, I'm a very superior pattern to the rest of them, although my type underneath thinks it's very inferior, and therefore that's one of the reasons why it thinks it's superior. So when I got that, I thought, really, I can stop doing all this nonsense. And I don't have to be hard on people any longer because they're just doing what they do. So I began to question, well, if this is not me, who am I? And it comes with no judgment, the Enneagram, in the way that I'm taught, it comes with observation. I began to question who I am. And that led to a deeper spiritual practice. And as far as I'm concerned, the Enneagram is bollocks unless you have a spiritual practice, because you cannot study the ego with the ego. The ego is threatened by a study of the Enneagram, and then it rearranges itself and says, right, I'm going to do a really good job of this for my ego, and I'm just going to do coffee table numbers and say my wicked mother-in-law, my first wife was this, and you know the president is that, and whatever, and whatever. And it becomes a silly number game.
Okay.
It's not important. The transformation of moving beyond the contraction and defense to a place of receptivity and openness is what it's about.
Okay, so what I
caught... I told you I talked a lot.
Well, what I caught in that, which was really, you know, kind of a doorway for me, so I'm going to grab the handle and hopefully open the door, is that you said that it's very important when introduced to the Enneagram that you have a spiritual practice. Can you say more about that in kind of very simple terms?
Yes, a spiritual practice for me, I have several things that I do, one of which, of course, is treating myself with Reiki. But if I sit and I become more present and I need to do this via my body, then I move into a natural part of myself. When I say I mean everybody, that I normally don't connect with, but is always connected with me, called the inner observer or witnessing consciousness. And this part sees things as they are, has no story, no investment, and makes no meaning of anything. It is impartial and continually compassionate, non-judgmental. And when I'm in that place, I begin to see that this thing that runs me is a mechanism that I need for my outer life, but it is not who I am.
Mm-hmm.
And when I let it go, and I see it as it is, a new sense of spaciousness and freedom can take place, and a deeper sense of compassion and connectivity. And a bigger question, who am I without all this reactivity and all these opinions and this story that my Enneagram type runs?
Okay, so if I... You know, we had this wonderful time together at this weekend I called the Sanctuary of Reiki Weekend. And
yes,
we talked a lot about filters. So here I'm going to use my Reiki filter in listening to what you said. So if I'm, you know, like sometimes when I'm, as I live my life in Reiki, I see that I'm impatient, and I get impatient for a number of different reasons in my life. You know, I have my whole setup. And if I can, I know that if I can take time to give myself a treatment in those critical moments where the reactive part of myself just gets turned on. And then once that gets turned on, I basically cannot stop it until it runs through its whole process. But if I want to stop the reaction, what I need to do or what I can do is to actually to sit down or lie down, do some treatment on myself, and that will put me into the space of being able to let that reaction go. And you described it in a different way, but I related it to the same way. It's easy to do that for kind of daily things that you don't have much attachment to, but then when you get to the really core issues, what happens?
Well, I have, if you could say, I have two practices. I mean, I have the practice of treating myself physically, which works on my physical body and on other levels, as you know better than I. And then I have a silent practice, which is where I sit quietly and I sit with attention. And one of Gurdjieff's prime core teachings was that we are three-brained animals. And we've been taught through the West to live in our heads. And we think, therefore I am. And in the Enneagram, we have three brains. We have a thinking brain, and we have a feeling brain, and we have a body brain. The body brain is the oldest, and it's the most instinctual and the fastest. The emotional brain is the second oldest and the second fastest. And the slowest, most sluggish brain is the head brain. And I need to be able to see these three brains and bring them back together so that they exist all at the same time, but I use the right brain in the right way, because I may not need an emotional brain when I'm doing my tax form.
Right.
So the inner observer sees what's going on, and I become more present, because if I have two of the brains present through the body, then I become the possibility of living in the present, which is the only thing I can have anyway. The present is the only thing I have, but the ego can never live in the present. It's always in the past or the future. So those two things complement my life. Now, I'm not good at admin, and I get tired of computers and papers and letters and emails and things, and can get quite neurotic about it. Often, I go upstairs in the middle of the afternoon, and I lie down for 10, 15 minutes, hands on. I do have a favorite position. And I'm transported away from all my reactions, all my rubbish. And I feel as if I've been on 2 weeks' holiday and put on some anti-wrinkling gel. And I come downstairs and I start again, and I'm like a newborn babe. That's Reiki.
Cool. So back to the Enneagram then. So the Enneagram then helps us pinpoint those things that we can choose to let go or not be at the effect of. Is that a better way to put it?
The Enneagram points out two qualities, an emotional quality and a mental quality that run your life. And they are the theme of your ego and your how you're experienced, and your limitations, and your inclinations, and your reactivity.
Mm-hmm.
Equally, there are two transpersonal qualities, one emotional and one mental. And these are holy, called holy, sacred qualities. They're transpersonal qualities. They're qualities of the soul. When most people study the Enneagram, they only look at their personalities. They tend to forget the higher qualities. The higher qualities are what we are here to manifest. They are what we need and what the world needs from us. You haven't done the Enneagram, but the quality of the type that you most probably are is innocence. So the highest quality in your being is pure innocence. And that's what you need, and that's what the world needs from you.
Mm-hmm.
Does that touch something in you?
Well, it's fascinating because, of course, what people have quite often done is go, oh, you're definitely a seven, or you're definitely this, you know, and then it just freaks me out and I turn it off and I don't think about it. But your question really touches something in me. So I'd love to think about that because or feel about it, maybe is a more accurate description of what I'd like to do. But it does touch me. Interesting.
Well, it's a very beautiful quality, in a sense, when it's manifest. When it's manifest, it's innocence, and it is an incredibly wonderful quality. But the contraction of innocence is rebellion and vengeance.
Mm-hmm.
And the type that particular type that I'm talking about, type 8, is the most reactive of all the types, the most quickly reactive, and can be perceived as being very aggressive.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's had experiences where its innocence was interfered with when they were young. And so they think they have to challenge everybody to maintain that nobody ever gets the better of them again. And of course, innocence is going back to a place of trust, a place where I can be despite whatever's going on. And I don't have to be assertive I can be trusting of people.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And trusting of myself. Innocence is an incredibly important quality.
Yes, well, I can relate to all that. Very much so.
I mean, I think it's one of the reasons why we like animals, because when we have animals, we sometimes are moved by their innocence, and certainly small children, they have that innocence, and that's why people melt around small babies, because they have that wonderful innocence intact.
Uh-huh. Huh. Interesting. So, do you at all ever combine, if combine is quite the right word, your Reiki practice and your Enneagram practice? Would you call it a practice?
Yes. I interestingly, my Reiki community overlaps with my Enneagram community, and that's partially of my own doing because I teach the Enneagram, as you know, for a living, so that I have taught Reiki people, but many Reiki people have done it. And I think they go hand in hand myself, because if you're going to be working in Reiki with patterns of things that you need to let go of and filters, it would be probably more wise or scientific to actually know the style of the filter and things you're trying to let go of. And so if you have this knowledge and you know, it doesn't take long for your people to see that it works, then you can send treatments to aspects of your behavior or your problems or your suffering or your past or your longings or whatever it is. So there can be a lot of specific healing work, especially with second degree.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, the whole thing about the Reiki space is non-judgment, and the whole thing about the Enneagram is, in a sense, it's ludicrous and funny, because there's 9 clowns, 9 different follies, 9 different magnificences, and it makes it all relative. So one of my opening lines when I teach is that we've forgotten how magnificent we are. And the Enneagram is about pinpointing something that had to happen, that we mistook for ourselves, and reconnecting with our magnificence through these divine qualities.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I agree with that. And I feel that Reiki brings that out also in a way, but it's more indirect somehow.
But it can be very direct, but it doesn't spell it out in a map or words. But I mean, I believe that when I treat myself, sometimes I move into the sublime space,
uh-huh.
and then I actually am completely transported away from my ordinary concerns and my ego, and I don't know where I am and who I am, and it doesn't make any difference. And when I come back, I'm a completely different person. It doesn't last. It lasts as long as I keep on practicing. I mean, it does last, but it doesn't last in the way that, in the material sense.
Right.
It's hungry for more attention, so I have more Reiki. But it has a cumulative build-up effect. Reiki has changed my life. But I know that if I have one of those experiences when I self-treat, that I may be grumpy in a few hours' time if I get my computer blows up.
Right, exactly.
You know, I might be quite grumpy. I might not be as bad as I might have been, but I could get grumpy again.
Right. And I think that that's that quality of seeing our progress of how long it takes us to get grumpy, for instance, is a really huge gift in Reiki. yes. allows us a relativity kind of thing. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. And the whole thing is a study of relativity. Because in the teaching of the Enneagram, I would ask, which legion of different personalities, sub-personalities, is grumpy? Because if someone said to me, you just want a ticket to go to Venice, can you get to Victoria Station and go on the Singleton Express, Orient Express? I'd say, I think so. You know, right. I'd probably pack my bags and go, thank you very much. Right. And I wouldn't be grumpy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. So who's grumpy? Somebody in the type that wants to identify and makes it meaningful and gets a payback from it and is habitual is grumpy.
Uh-huh.
I don't need to be grumpy.
This word that you just said, habitual, is one of my key words when I teach these days, because I've realized in my own life that Reiki is teaching me to not be a habitual creature. And that kind of goes against, it seems like, everything that we're taught as children. Because, you know, you get into the habit of doing this, or you get into the habit of doing that. And it's because it's socially acceptable or socially appropriate or something that hinges, there's some survival mechanism that gets triggered. So, you know, I've been practicing not being habitual, which has been a very incredible practice for me. And I see that it would be interesting for me to kind of get these three minds, because then it's much easier for me to connect with the part of myself that is the habitual. I don't have to include all of me. I can do this one part, which makes it a little less daunting. Do you know what I'm saying? Can you follow what I'm saying?
Yes, I'm very, very interested. I'm enjoying this experience.
Yeah. So, you know, so tell me again what the three minds are.
Well, the three minds, three centers, we have, and each one has a lower and higher aspect, but the first brain is the instinctual brain. And there's three, as you know, there's nine types of Enneagram types. There's three instinctual gut belly types, and they're anger types in the Enneagram, and their energy moves against. And then the next brain to develop is the feeling heart brain, which is the brain of connectivity. Uh-huh. Again, there's three types as well. And we call these the image types or the desirings. And these people have low self-esteem and they arrange themselves so that others will like them, so that they move towards people hoping people will like them.
Uh-huh.
And then there's the last three brains, which is the Lewis brain, to develop the frontal brain, the rational, the systematic, the computer brain, the sequential brain. And this is the brain of the head. And this brain is often called the fear brain, or the fear types. People that don't quite get the belly and don't quite get the emotions and want to go away and rationalize it or think about it or look it up online before they experience it directly. And they're frightened. So they're fear types, and they move away from things. So you've got three different types of people: moving against, moving towards, and moving away. And we use all three, but we have a preference for one, which is related to our type. But our Western society thinks that the brain, the front brain, the intellectual brain, the slow, sluggish brain that adds things up and makes computers and things, is the only brain, really, and the only one of any merit.
Right.
And this is not true. The body never lies, the other brains lie. I mean, that's one of the interesting things about Reiki, is that Reiki doesn't lie.
Exactly.
So I would trust the body brain first and foremost, although I'm a heart type by preference, and I'd probably move into the head pretty easily. But it's the body that actually, if I'm involved with somebody and I have funny feelings, I say, what's your gut instinct?
Right.
and my gut instinct says, this is not a good place to be, then I would take heed of it.
Right. Well, it's interesting because if I can use you as an example in this particular construct, your natural inclination would be emotional, right?
Yes. Or,
and then the second one would be your head. And so what Reiki has given you is a pathway or a way to connect with the body brain.
I have, this is true, absolutely. And also within Enneagram, you have three of the nine types working for you, and depending on what your configuration is. And so I have two hearts and one body link.
Uh-huh.
But I also go to this, my neighbor, which is a head link, and I've overdeveloped that one. But I do have a body link within the system, so I have that as well. But Reiki gives me a direct on-hands contact with my physical being and the energy that permeates everything. And it doesn't lie.
Doesn't lie. Oh, I have found that to be so true. And it's it is amazing to me how much I operate on that. It's like everything from the mundane choice of buying a bottle of wine, like I don't actually drink wine a lot. But I can go into a wine shop and I can hold a bottle of wine and just feel what it does to my body. And if I like the feeling, then I'll buy the bottle of wine. It always fits for the people that I'm buying it for, which is really interesting. And then, you know, you get to a point where, you know, you're in a situation and you go, I think I should move, because your body's so uncomfortable, it just wants to get up and move somewhere. So you move, and then something happens, you know, in the next moment where you go, well, I'm really glad I moved, because that wouldn't have been a good place to be. And I find this whole body orientation very interesting, because I didn't have it consciously, you know, as a young adult. I did develop this over my years of practice, because I feel like just guessing, and because of my own sort of study of myself, that I surely must be an emotional brain person. Because everything comes through my emotions. And it's interesting. But maybe not. Maybe I'm something
else.
Well,
I would guess that you're a body type. And I wouldn't guess. I would say I pretty well kind of get that.
Uh-huh.
And I get that through my body. But you have a strong link with a heart type. And it would be very much part of your nature, I think, to be a person that would be wanting to help people and connect with people and be able to work appropriately with people's giftings and
mm-hmm.
encourage people to develop in that way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Great. So listeners, you know, just as you're listening, just see how subtle this is. Instead of somebody coming up to me and saying, you're a 7 in the Enneagram, you know, Gordon is like giving me these little hints, which are very wonderful, and they touch me at a, you know, they go into me instead of from my rational brain, they go into me in another way, and I can feel the truth of them, which is a fascinating experience, actually. Well, if any of you would love to know more about the Enneagram and perhaps even pick Gordon's brain for yourselves, you can connect with him. I assume you have a website, Gordon?
I'm on websites, but I'm very lazy. I haven't created one for myself. I have an email address. They can use that if they want.
Okay, great.
I'm very happy to, because I travel with my work. I teach in other countries, and I'm happy to go anywhere. I'd be even happy to go to America, but I would love it.
Great.
I did some of my training in America.
Great, great. And so then we're just going to link back to the Enneagram, and then Your Reiki path has become a bit more developed these days. Is that true?
Yes, I had a very interesting experience. I have now a new Reiki passion. It's not a Reiki passion, but a new thing that I do each year and I value enormously. I go on a silent retreat in a monastery in Holland led by a Reiki master that you know, Rebecca. And I just absolutely love it. I'd rather go there than have a holiday. It's 5 days. She holds the space absolutely beautifully with great integrity. And it's one of the most deep and profound experiences I can possibly imagine. I absolutely love it. I booked for next year. Wouldn't miss it for anything. And I went the first time thinking, why am I going? And I told her I wanted to go. And she said, oh, well, I don't have an application form in English. I said, well, I'm coming. You said I could come. I'm coming. And normally I'd be all sort of, sorry, you know, you have to do all that extra work. But I said, I'm coming. So I came. And she wasn't expecting people from the UK to come. Anyway, I came. And good job, a silent retreat, eh? You know, I didn't have to talk very much.
Do you really have to speak Dutch?
No, I didn't have to speak at all. And during the retreat, things intensified. And I thought that I was eating too much bread. And this is true, because they just eat bread all the time in the monastery. And I thought, maybe I've eaten too much bread and I'm getting high on wheat or something. But I thought, I kept a diary. I said, I think I'm being called to be a Reiki master. Now, I went to see a medium a few months before, and she said, why aren't you a Reiki master? I said, well, I'll only be a Reiki master if I'm called to be one, and it's too late now, I won't be. So there's that. And she said, well, you are a Reiki master already, but you don't know it, and you will be one, because you're meant to be one. I said, well, I won't unless I get the call in. And she said, well, you'll get the call in. I said, well, I won't. But if I do, I'll do something about it. So that was that. And then, you know, 2 months later, I'm in this monastery, and I just burst into tears, and I just think, my God, I'm being called just like I was as a priest to become a Reiki master.
That's
and I just cried and cried and cried and cried and cried. I went for long walks, and I thought, I think I'm going to have to tell Rebecca that this is happening. And I told her, and, well, the past, the rest is history. But I also got the master that I was supposed to be under, and I thought, I don't have any doubt of it. I know I'm meant to approach her, and if she doesn't want to do it, then she won't do it. But she's going to do it because she's meant to do it. And I just did it. So that's been happening. Very slow process. I mean, I can't say that I can see any results, and that's very good. But it certainly has pulled me up, because this mastery thing has been asking me all sorts of questions about my life, my shadows, my motivation. Why would I want to do this? What am I going to do with it? All sorts of things. So it's been quite a journey, and it's been amazing. And I'm convinced I'm meant to do it. And I'm in it.
Wow. That's a wonderful story. And it's really inspiring. Because I think that the question of why are you doing it, there's really no rational answer to that, because it's simply a calling. And
yes.
So it includes, for me, the beauty of your story also is that it includes the mystery that is inherent in all of our, you know, in all of our lives when it comes to our spiritual callings, whether it be from Reiki or through the church or on the top of a hill or on the top of a mountain or something. There's this mystic experience that I find really valuable. And maybe I'm just a mystic at heart. I have no idea.
You probably are.
So, when you say that it's going slowly, what do you mean by that?
Well, that comes from my reactivity and my personality and my type, of course. It's going as it's going, and I understand that. My Reiki master lives at no real fixed address, as you know, and is a bit nomadic. And so She hasn't been able to give me any dates that I could actually attend because they're all the dates that she sent me earlier in the year I was working. And she hasn't sent any dates lately. So I haven't done anything in the ordinary sense. But I don't think that matters because all the while I'm doing everything. I'm working in my Reiki home, in my Reiki family, because I've moved by instinct. Part-time I live in a place where one of the masters of our system has initiated over 500 people, and they're all living nearby, Kristen, Bonnie, as you know. And so all those people are there. The people that I'm renting my flat from, and I didn't know that they were part of my Reiki family, are initiated by her. I'm surrounded by people from my lineage and from my family, from this system. So Reiki's everywhere. So I'm writing this book, which probably is going to put everything together in a funny kind of way for me in this life. And there I am, just surrounded by Reiki. And I think, yeah, you know, I'm in the right place. And there I am, working on myself beside this river, which is really confronting me and teaching me. I didn't know the river was going to have such a big effect because my flats smack on the river and it annoys me. It never stops. It's always in the present moment. Mm. Very powerful. But it's a fantastic place to do the mastery work. And so I think I'm doing the mastery work all the time, but I'm not doing things in the ordinary level, like, you know, oh, yes, I've learned this and I've learned that and I know how to do this and I know the Reiki story inside out. And, yeah, it's not like that.
Right. Well, as far as in my own heart, I feel like this is really the true path of mastery. The other part, which has to do with the information and stuff, is easily given. But this other part is not given, it's received. And it seems like you're in a great place to be receptive.
And I really thank you for that. I've written that down. That touch moves and inspires me. I think that's true. And I've had some people that have said to me, well, why would you want to do Reiki? Because you can't do Reiki and the Enneagram. And I just look at them and think, well, I can, and I will, because I'm called to do it. So, you know, get over it. And sometimes it's a bit lonely because you can see some people that don't take it very seriously. And I just thought, don't worry about it. It comes from my reactivity. It comes from their stuff. Just leave it be. What will be. And if you're meant to be a Reiki master, you will be. And then someone wanted to check my passion about the thing. And I said, well, why would you want to teach it when you're so passionate about the Enneagram? I said, I cannot wait to teach the story and to put my being into that story and the excitement of the initiations and know that they're going to go away with this incredible means to bring healing to themselves and others.
Mm-hmm.
I want to be part of it. Even if I only initiate 10 people, I have to do it. It's part of what I'm here to do. And I want to be, I can't wait to do it. When it's right, I want to do it. I'm unstoppable.
That I believe.
So there you are.
Wonderful. I love it. Of course. Oh.
I'm smiling.
So I have just one more question to ask you, then we must end. So can I ask what the topic of your book?
Yes, my book is called Grounded for the Time of Your Life.
Sounds like a song title.
Well, it's a book about being a spirit in a body and remembering that I came from somewhere else. Uh-huh. And looking at life as a schoolroom and looking at all the different stages and hurdles of being an outer person and then letting that outer person go and just be an intelligent mechanism and becoming who I really am, whom I don't know. And it's funny and it's humorous and it's abstract and it's bonkers, but it's fun. And the subtitle, I think, is great because I'm grounded for the entirety of my life. I mean, I'm born and then I'll die and then I won't be grounded. But I'm taking the mickey out of that by saying, for the time of your life, I'm having the time of my life doing this.
Right.
So it's a kind of double-edged take. Yes, I'm here. I'm a spirit in a body for X years.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm also, in a funny kind of way, having an amazing time being this being doing this being.
Oh, Gordon, It sounds like a great book. I can't wait.
Well, I don't know. I'm not a natural writer, but it's going to be done.
All right. Great. Well, you definitely have will in the very most beautiful sense of the word. So I believe that it will be done, as you will be also a Reiki master.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, wonderful. Gordon, thank you so much for sharing everything that you have today. And thank you for your time. It's been great.
Well, thank you, Phyllis. It's been lovely to have this contact with you.
Yes. Thank you.
Bless you.
This is Phyllis Furumoto with Reiki, Balancing Form and Essence.